To talk one more thing into this thing of suffering. I want to delve one more step down into it. It has to do with understanding Dhamma a little bit more as to what it is that we're doing when we're delving into Dhamma this way. So I got a couple of examples that I want to use to try to help explain what Dhamma is. So the first example is of a scarecrow. So we think of crows, and they want to eat the corn out of the farm. And so basically, they don't have any hesitation about going and eating your corn. And I remember one time driving across Nebraska, seeing all these cornfields with these figures. These kind of, I guess they just look like sticks in some places, but some of them had like crossbar for arms and clothes on them. But basically, you can think about it, crows have seen humans before, right? So they know humans more powerful than me. So they're not going to mess with them, I think. Even though I've had an experience with crows that they're pretty smart. They know. Okay, I got to tell you. I can't believe this happened to me. So I was at Samish Island, you know, that campground up there at Samish Island. They have a campground up towards Bellingham. And I was on this long walk during lunchtime and saw this crow sitting on this, like a telephone wire. And I started laughing at the crow, saying, oh, you're all by yourself. See, you probably don't get along with people. You ain't got no homies, you know. Everybody's tired of you. And it was just kind of calm by itself. And I'm just laughing at it, making fun of it. Like, nobody really wants to hang with you. You're all by yourself. That's what you get. You're probably mean. And I didn't think nothing of it. So the next day, I go on my long walk. I'm not even paying attention to what I said yesterday. And then all of a sudden, I get to that section. I hear this crow cawing and all these other crows cawing. There must have been like 15 crows. And I was like, oh, so you got your friends with you? And as I would walk, they kept moving down the road. I'm like, oh my God, I totally got these crows mad at me. So, and you know, with crows, I heard that it passes down to their generation, so their kids is mad at you, and it just never goes. Anyway, so scarecrows, they might seem like they're smart, crows might seem like they're smart, but a scarecrow is just a bundle of straw, some stuff put together, or a stick with just a cloth draped over them. Some of the scarecrows are really quite simple. But it's just, this guy that does all our farming said, it's just, we just put up something so that the crow thinks there's a human standing there, and they are going to wait until the human leaves. Now, if the crow got up close, they might notice that the thing's not moving. That it's not like what they think of as humans. It's not doing something. It's not real. They could notice that if they get up close. But usually, from far away, they decide that's a human, and then they move on to another field. So the idea is that's what the distortion is doing to us. We decide what the situation is in this moment based on what the distortion tells us is happening. The information they're giving us is not necessarily the truth of what's happening. But they could be, you could think of it like a warning signal. There's a way in which the distortion is actually helping us see something because of the suffering we feel. I don't know if the last time I was here, I told you guys about, you know, getting all hooked on this, I got hooked on this TV show. Did I tell you about my little romance with a TV character? It's embarrassing. So, I have a vow of celibacy, and I don't really do the whole falling in love thing, haven't for years and years and years, and I don't even think about it. I mean, I'm just not going to be in a relationship like that. But something happened. I was watching this TV show, watching it every day, and you know, it's not like it used to be where you could watch it once a week and that would save you. Now, you can watch like 9,000 episodes at one time, over and over and over. But the show was getting a little difficult for me. I didn't really like the show anymore and I wanted to get rid of it. I just wanted to stop watching it. So I'm walking home from work one day and I just randomly said, that's it. I'm not going to watch that show anymore. I've had enough. And before I got home, I'm walking, I got desperate. I mean upset. The mind was freaking out because I had said I wasn't going to watch this show anymore. And I'm realizing that I am so attached to one of the TV characters that the idea of not seeing him was like too much for me. I couldn't take it. So bad. I called my son who was newly married and I said, I can't believe it. I think I am in love with a TV character and I can't, I need some help. I don't know what I'm going to do. And he laughed at me and he goes, Mama, you just got to, in relationships, you just got to take the good and the bad. So I'm trying my best. At first, I don't really want to accept that I'm so attached to this TV character, but I could feel this deep panic that was coming over me. And so by the time I got home, you know, I turned the TV on and I watched that show and I was all settled. But I sent a note to my teacher, Rodney, and I asked him, like, what is this that's happened here? How can I be so attached to a TV show? This doesn't make any sense. How did this happen? And he said something that I've never forgotten. I've lived with this for the rest of my days from it, probably until I die. He said that, Tori, we are asleep 90% of the time. We don't know that we're asleep because we're asleep. It's only when something feels difficult, suffering, some pain arises, some discomfort arises, that we wake up. And in that moment, you can either go back to sleep or you can move towards awakening. One of the two. That's why Buddha pointed to there is suffering as the first of the ennobling truths. It's only when something difficult shows up that we pay attention, wake up and say, what's going on here? Something's amiss. We gotta fix this. So in some respects, that's what these distortions are. As soon as we feel that difficult, we're in a choice here to either go back to sleep or move towards some possibility of awakening. Another way you could think of these distortions is sort of like a magic show, right? If you go to a magic show, you could get all caught up in trying to figure out, how did they do that? How did they do that? And then you're caught in you're sort of where the magician wants you to be, because you're so engrossed in what they're doing, you're no longer paying attention. You forget that it is a magic show, so it's pretend. And you begin to see it as being real. But if you hold the show as a magic show, it's entertainment, it's not real, then you can enjoy it for the fun of it and go about your business, because you're not intertwined in trying to figure out how is it that magic show happens. So in some respects, if we get too caught up in the distortions, trying to understand how to keep myself from being in a distortion, we're going to get lost. Because the distortions are happening constantly. Instead, you use the warning signal of some discomfort to tell you something's amiss here. And look at how, consider how you can change that, or how you can release yourself from the distortion and see it more realistically the way it is. So I have come up with 9 ways to see distortions. But because it's 9 ways to see distortions, and we have less than an hour together, it would be way too much information, and we would miss 90% of it. So I have a different way that I'd like to do it. I'm going to talk a little bit about how to hold the Dhamma and give you the nine ways to see distortions as homework. And then I want to give you an assignment on how to contemplate with them, to see them. And then tomorrow, we're going to talk our way through them. When we have more space and capacity, and you've spent the day now contemplating the idea that suffering may not be quite as bad as we thought it was, and there might be a way out of it. So I got 3 things here, and I think if we look at Dhamma as what Dhamma's trying to do, we might can begin to see how it is that these 9 modes of the distortions actually can become more of a guide for us and help us a little bit more. So the first kind of misunderstanding of Dhamma is that Dhamma is somehow a healing process. I'm going to get healed if I do this practice. Dhamma does not heal you. First of all, Dhamma doesn't think there's anything wrong with you. So it doesn't have this inherent capacity to heal you. In fact, I sometimes think if the Buddha were to come to some of our circles and talk to us, we would be so upset with him, because he would probably sound cold and disheartened. In some respects, the Dhamma is like that. It's not going to heal you of the difficulty you're having. It's going to tell you you're having a difficulty there. It's just going to keep pointing. Look, you need to work on that. Something's amiss here. You need to work on that. It's just going to keep pointing. At some point, if we stop trying to see past the difficulty towards the healing aspect of Dhamma, I think some healing happens. But it doesn't come from the Dhamma. It comes from our no longer trying to fix ourselves. It comes from freeing ourselves from the need to be healed. That there's a sense, I think, that we feel like we're healed. So in one way to think about it, Dhamma is pointing to wisdom, so we can see things as it actually is, and that does not require us to be healed. The reason why I'm saying this way is because I came from a lot of trauma. And I told some of the groups, you know, I came from a really messed up family. And so when I came into the Dhamma, that's what I was looking for. I thought I'm going to get healed from all the difficulties that I was having. But because I came from so much trauma, the very place that I needed to go, which is embodied, Dhamma, this practice we're doing, is an embodied practice. The very place I needed to go, that's the last place I'm going. We're not going in the body. I can work this out in my mind, but I can't work it out in the body. And that's where I had to go. So in order for me to go into the body, I had to do some healing work, but that was not from the Dhamma. That was from therapy and stuff like that. The Dhamma was the sort of capacity, gave me the capacity, I guess is the best way to say it, to look at some stuff that I needed to look at. But it did not heal me. So once you realize that there's no real problem, I mean, if you have some need for therapy, then you have to go to therapy like I did. But aside from assuming everybody has a basically healthy way of being, the first thing we got to stop doing is calling something a problem. There's nothing that needs to be healed. There's nothing that needs to be fixed. There is something that needs to be seen. You might have to wipe the dirt off of the lens a little bit and get some Windex there to clean it up so you can see clearer, but you're not trying to heal yourself. The Dhamma, secondly, is not something we acquire. So we live in this very conditioned world, and conditions are coming together and falling apart and coming together and falling apart. And there's nothing that the Dhamma can do that's going to help you, get past that. So the person that's going out the door, I don't want to put you on the spot. But are you coming back tomorrow?
I am.
Good. You better take your homework. Okay. Matthew. Try to get out of not doing the homework. Okay, so just so you know, just take some time, spend like 20 minutes, look at that, and find the one that resonates most with you. And then just sit quietly with it and see what comes. Okay, see you tomorrow. So this idea that we're going to get something, acquire something, that if we practice long enough and strong enough, we're going to get somewhere, that idea we have to sort of let go of. I was telling people on the retreat that I realized that when I realized that even if I were to awaken, there wouldn't be a Tuareg there awoke. You know, I wouldn't know that I'm awakened. By the time you get to the place of awakening, there's no self there. There's no me. So I can't go running around telling all my friends, see, I did it. I did it. I know what I was doing. I told you I could do this. There wouldn't be that kind of concept. Because most of if we're trying to get somewhere, it's actually the opposite for Dhamma. It can't help us if I'm trying to get somewhere. So what we're trying to do is let go of this need to acquire some state of being, some peacefulness, some aspect of where we think we're trying to get. We're just trying to see clearer what's going on. We're just actually trying to focus the lens a little bit clearer on the present moment. We're not going anywhere else, not getting anywhere else. And then the last one is kind of, or I guess before I leave the second one, this in this acquiring. Part of the reason why we get this sense of acquiring, sort of like I look at my teacher, and I looked at all these teachers, and I listened to all these Dhamma talks, and everybody talks about all this love, and this beauty, and this joy, and I want to get that. That's what I want to get. But there's a difference between trying to get joy and experiencing joy, which is what the third one is. That the Dhamma is more of something you actually experience. So the only way you can experience it is you have to be willing to be with whatever is there. We have to be willing to be with discomfort and difficulty in order to experience something different in relation to with it. We have to give up this need to try to get rid of the discomfort and instead try to see, is there a way that I could be with this moment and not have it be anything different? What would happen if the very things that we think are the worst, the worst, the worst, if we could try to just experience it as it is without trying to make it something different? Seems kind of hard, doesn't it? Yeah. But in our efforts to try to fix ourselves, to try to get some state, we are completely disrupting our capacity to directly experience liberation. It's like our minds are getting in the way of the very thing we're trying to experience. And that mind getting in the way is dukkha. It's samsara. It's the nature of suffering. It's what Buddha was pointing to. Once he divided his mind and let go of this fixing, angry, problem mind, he could move into this capacity for liberation. So then I thought, okay, I can do that. So I watched, like the Buddha watched his mind, I looked at all the areas in which I think of problem solvings. When I can't see the three characteristics, I can't see that I'm stuck in some distortion, and that's what I came up with. So Metta has this sheet that basically has these nine, it's three in each category. Three in the impermanence category, three in dissatisfaction, three in non-self. I called them modes, and you can kind of see what the mode is for each one of those categories. They're all going to be very familiar with you. The idea is to begin to see, we have all nine of these all the time. So you want to see, is there one that maybe resonates with you more than the others? One that you seem to always get caught in that mode? And so tomorrow we're going to practice. I just want you to contemplate it a little bit. Just see if you can be quiet and consider. It's sort of like reflecting. You're not so much analyzing so much, but reflecting on how does this show up all the time? So we can begin to see, is there a way that we could notice this and be freed from the suffering that's connected to it? All of these nine ways are suffering. A couple of quotes before I go, before I end this. Here's one from Ajahn Chah. He's one of my favorite teachers. That's why I quote him so much. His name is Ajahn Chah. Ajahn just means like reverend or teacher.
Okay. And the surname is?
Chah. C-H-A-H.
C-H-A-H?
Mm-hmm. C-H-A-H. He was a Thai forest monk. And Thai forest monks, I like them because they're a little rowdy in some respects, you know. I mean, they live in the forest. So just to give you an example, one of the premier teachers, his name is Ajahn Mun, and Ajahn Mun became a novice monk when he was about, I think he was 10 or 11 years old. He died a monk, so he lived his whole life as a monk. But he didn't go, he never went to school, didn't study anything. He went through the basic monk stuff that they learn. But basically what he did was, when he got of age and they let him, he left and went into the forest. And when he went into the forest, I understand that there were Bengal tigers that would go around pretty happy that the monks were coming into the forest because lunch was served. And all these monks would be terrified of being eaten by tigers. But Ajahn just went into the forest, and this is what he said. If I come up on a tiger and he's hungry, it's all over. I mean, I can try to run, but they're much more powerful than I am. And so I need to practice being prepared to die, if that's the way it's going to be. If I come up on a tiger and he's not hungry, what do I have to worry about? He's not going to eat me. He's fine. They're not going to just eat. I mean, we're the only beings that eat whether we're hungry or not. Everybody else, all the other species, they only eat when they're hungry. When they're not hungry, they don't eat. I don't know why we have a problem with that. But nonetheless, he's not going to eat me. And so he would just go into the forest, and they said that by the time he got to be a much more senior monk, you would see him with tigers sitting around him. He just had a way in which he was part of the forest and not against the forest. And so in some respects, these Thai forest monks, I think that's the way their energy is, very much being apart. So you'll see here, he says, how does the Dhamma teach the proper way of life? It shows us how to live. It has many ways of showing it, on roots of trees or just in front of you. It is a teaching, but not in words. So still the mind, the heart, and learn to watch. You'll find the whole Dhamma revealing itself here and now. At what other time or place are you going to look for it? That kind of thing. It's learning to be able to be with whatever is coming up without it having to be otherwise. Whatever's there, it's going to show you something. But if you fix it, you're not going to be able to know what it's going to show you. Pema Chodron says, the peace that we're looking for is not peace that crumbles as soon as there is difficulty or chaos. Whether we're seeking inner peace or global peace or a combination of the two, the way to experience it is built on the foundation of unconditional openness to all that arises. Peace isn't an experience free of challenge, free of rough and smooth. It's an experience that's expansive enough to include all that arises without feeling threatened. I think Pema Chodron is like the queen of suffering. She has seen through a lot. Here's another Milarepa. I like him because I grew up with a lot of anger. So he's my kindred spirit. I use this quote a lot, so you may have heard it before. When you run after your thoughts, you're like a dog chasing a stick. Every time a stick is thrown, you run after it. Instead, be like a lion who, rather than chasing after the stick, turns to face the thrower. One only throws a stick at a lion once. That's what we're learning to do. We're learning to look at. We don't want to run from the difficulty, because the difficulty, the mere fact that you know there's a difficulty happening, means you're awake. And in that awake state, you have the greatest possibility to free yourself. But if you just react to the difficulty and make it go away, fix it so that it's not there anymore, you're basically lulling yourself back to sleep again. And everything's all smooth again, and everybody's sleep and calmed down. One more. Oh, two more. Thich Nhat Hanh says, it's not impermanence that makes us suffer. What makes us suffer is wanting things to be permanent when they're not. That makes sense?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? You see what these guys, all these people are pointing to? Something. That's what we want to see. I can't tell you what it is, because if you were experiencing difficulty right now and we were trying to explain it, we could try to get to that. But instead, you're listening to something and it has to encourage you enough to have you try it when a difficulty shows up. That's why I'm reading all these different ways of saying it. Matthew Ricard, who's another Tibetan, says that when the mind is full of memories and preoccupied by the future, it misses the freshness of the present moment. In this way, we fail to recognize the luminous simplicity of mind that is always present behind the veil of thought. That's what we want to see. I'm hoping you'll be able to see how still and peaceful the mind is 90% of the time. Most of the time. The only way we know that the mind is still is when something happens and our thinking mind gets disrupted. And when it gets disrupted, we feel discomfort. And when we feel that discomfort, we try to fix that and then go back to sleep. But instead, if we try to find the spaciousness in that suffering, then we can begin to see that there's something else here besides just our habitual way of moving through the world. And we're going to talk about what that something else is tomorrow. So, let me end with a poem. I think this is a good poem that that gets to what I'm saying. It's by Julie Cadwalader Stobbs. She says, I am 52 years old and have spent truly the better part of my life out of doors. But yesterday, I heard a new sound above my head, a rustling, ruffling quietness in the spring air. And when I turned my face upward, I saw a flock of blackbirds rounding a curve I didn't know was there. And the sound was simply all those wings, all those feathers against air, against gravity, and such a beautiful whining. The whole flock taking a long, wide turn, as if one body and one mind. How do they do that? If we lived only in human society, what a puny existence that would be. But instead, we live and move and have our being here in this curving and soaring world that is not our own, so that when mercy and tenderness triumph in our lives, and when, even more rarely, we unite and move together towards a common good, we can think to ourselves, ah, yes, this is how it's meant to be. That's pretty, isn't it? I know, I like it. So, we have a little bit of time for some questions. See if anybody has any questions about the homework or about... I know you haven't seen the sheets yet, but... Or what we're going to do, or just what you've heard today, you know, maybe a comment about what you've heard, doesn't matter, whatever it is. Yeah?
I was out walking in the forest. kindness that you just come back to this moment, come back to this step, just come back to this room. And I was just realizing that my senses are just all sort of telling me this repeatedly. My ear is hearing that rustle over there.
That's right.
Over there. My eyes picking up that flash of light off that leaf there. And that really, I don't have to rely on anything but what is built into me, the senses, to keep bringing back again and again and again.
Quite beautiful. I could not have said that better. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's already there. It's not an effort. It's more of a willingness. And we just practice strengthening that willingness more and more and more. And it's quite beautiful. Nothing's happening, but it's quite beautiful. Very nice.
I would like to say that I have really enjoyed this day. And I've come to a few of these things. I'm kind of new to a lot of this. But I've really enjoyed it because of what you've expressed to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a sense that you're a very deep person,
mm-hmm.
based on whatever life has thrown your way. And I really appreciate the way you've communicated to us, in the way you've answered things.
Great.
That people have asked.
Great.
And it's a rare gift. And you've done a lovely job.
Well, thank you kindly. I feel great. Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah, it and some of this is because I've already lived through this mess. And so there's a way in which I took the time to watch it instead of being thankful I was past it. And so I just tell you what I've already seen. And that's pretty much what it is.
Well, it's very different the way you've presented today.
Good. Great, that's beautiful. Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
How long would you advise someone to just observe pain in the body for it, like be us and do something?
You mean like physical pain?
Yeah.
So, the thing about physical pain is there's two types of pain. I guess I'm going to say it like this. Two types of pain. One is emotional and one is physical. Emotional pain, even the emotional pain around something physical, that is what Dhamma is directed at. Physical pain that's related to the physicality, the biology of the body, that is not for Dhamma. And Dhamma won't do anything to help that. Can you see the difference between what I'm saying? So think of it like this. I threw my back out once. I think the original throwing out my back was because of emotional stress. But nonetheless, I literally threw my back out. And I was bedridden for about a month. After about a month, I did some exercising, chiropractor, took some muscle relaxers, did all the stuff to try to help deal with my back. I could start moving about again. And then I spent a year doing all these core strengthening exercises to strengthen my back. And then about a year into it, I go to this retreat with my teacher, and the first full day, the first morning of this retreat, I reach for the butter at breakfast and my back goes out again. So my teacher asked me, he said, "Tuari, is this physical or emotional? If it's physical, you may have to leave the retreat, you may have to go home and do some whatever work to help strengthen your back, right? If it's emotional, then the Dhamma can help you. But the only one that knows that is you." So I thought it couldn't possibly be physical. Because I had done all this work to strengthen my back. I had, it just felt like it was emotional. And it was. because I did a lot of practice with the pain, and it actually shifted everything. So a couple of things to do if you think it's emotional. You got to stop calling it pain. Because if you call it pain, it's like there's a problem and I got to fix it. The problem is this pain and I got to fix it. So you're telling the mind to fix something that it keeps concretizing as a thing. And it can't do that. It keeps creating pain and then you got to try to fix it. And then it creates pain and you got to try to fix it. So you have to let go of the word pain. That's why Dhamma teachers say let go of the word pain. And call it sensation. It is a sensation. It's unpleasant, doesn't feel right, sharp, painful, but it's not pain. It's a sensation. Then you got to break it down into what is actually happening, right? So is the descriptive nature of that sensation, and you want to see, is it changing? Is it moving? Is there space between it? What happens when you start doing this, if it's emotional, if your pain is like the aversion to this chronic illness? I have this chronic pain and I have aversion to it. That is what's causing us the bulk of the difficulty. So in order for you to see that aversion, then you have to stop calling it my back pain, my knee pain, my shoulder pain, and you have to just let it be sensation and feel into the nature of that and learn to see the impermanent nature of it, the dukkha aspect of it, and that it's not really about you. It's just the nature of the body in this moment in time. And then the third thing, which is the most important, is to notice when the sensation is not there. It puts space there. So you're not, this is all when that pain is connected to some sadness, disappointment, wishing, aversion, it's not here. That kind of overlay on top of our chronic condition is what's causing most of our suffering. That's why John Kabat-Zinn got so famous, because he did this huge study, and all he did was took a little wand, heated it up, not so much that it would burn you, not like a curling iron wand, and he would just bring it up against somebody. He got all these practitioners together, and he lined all these people up, some practitioners, some not. And basically, he did this long study that was quite simplified. He would take the wand, and he would bring it up against the leg or some body part and say, okay, as soon as it gets to a 10, tell me when it's a 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You tell me. And then tell me how long you can stay there. So, people would sit down. He would start bringing the wand towards them. The researchers bring it the wand towards them. They'll be like, "That's a 10. I can't. I can take it. Okay, okay. 10. Okay, it's 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then they could barely, it would get like here. And they're like, "It's too much. I can't take it." Then they'd go meditate. Do this guided meditation. They're now in the body, settled in the body. Go back, do the same thing. They'd start bringing it towards them. They'd get past the 10 level, the 9 level, the 8 level, the 7 level. They get pretty close. They're like, that's a 10. And then they could hold it longer. And then what he realized, he published those results. That's what blew the lid off of mindfulness and meditation, is because he proved that when people are in their body, they can handle way more stress and pressure than when they're in their head thinking about it. So what he concluded was, when people think they're going to be burned, they can't handle it very much. But when they go with just the felt sense of what it feels like, they could handle it. So that's sort of why you're working with pain the way you're working with it. That's why teachers say to stop calling it pain. Basically, you got to decide, is this physical or is this emotional? If it's, what I mean by emotional, is this my aversion? Is this dread or disappointment or all those emotional things that get attached to a physical sensation? So if it's emotional, that's the part you're going to work on. You're going to stop calling it pain. Just let it be sensation. Open it up and watch the impermanent nature of it, the direct experience of it, and notice when it's not present. Those kinds of things create the space around it such that you can be with even chronic illnesses in a much better, kinder way. Okay? Good. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Depression's along the same line. So we have, for those of us that have lived with a lot of depression over many, many years, we have a mind that habitually goes to depression. That's the way it goes when we cannot deal with it. So there's two kinds of depression, I think. There's the chronic depression that really needs antidepressants and some kind of a therapeutic process, because I don't think it's just, oh, I feel blue. That kind of thing. And then there's the chronic go-to hiding that we do when things get overwhelming. It's that chronic go-to habitual way of hiding that I think Dhamma can work with. Can't work with the, basically you need to go get an antidepressant because you don't have enough of the positive chemicals in the body's not producing enough to help you stay steady. Because we do have a body that knows how to produce enough of the downsizing hormones and the upsizing hormones to keep us steady. We don't have to keep ourselves steady. The body does that automatically. But if that hormone production gets thrown off, then we're trying to buck up and be okay, and it doesn't really work like that. But even when our hormones can basically produce an appropriate level of chemicals, if we have the habit of hiding, which was my problem, the habit of hiding from everything difficult, then we have to see that habit. And that is along the same lines. You have to know this is not physical. This is not this is mind. It's not the body not producing enough adrenaline and support for me. This is me having the habit of hiding. And
are you saying hiding?
Hiding, H-I-D-I-N-G, hiding. Mm-hmm. Like going under the, for me it was like I'd get in bed and I wouldn't come out because I was too overwhelmed, too scared. So I'm just stuck in the bed. I had to help myself see that this is a habit. What got me to begin to see this is I went to a therapist one time and I was so depressed and I'm like, I'm going home, I'm taking tomorrow off, I'm so depressed, and I'm getting ready to leave her and she goes, well, I hope you have a good day tomorrow. And I'm looking at her like, what are you? I said I'm depressed, I can't have a good day, I was so mad. Like, how can you say that? That's so like demeaning and blah, 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 blah. She's just sitting there and she goes, worry. You could have a good day even if you're depressed. I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about. I go home. I get my boys off to school. I'm in the bed. I'm not going to do nothing because I'm depressed. And I don't know if you guys ever saw the movie Overboard, but it is the funniest, most hilarious movie ever written. It's like Birdcage. Have you seen that? Oh my God, some of you guys have seen Birdcage. Well, Overboard is Goldie Hawn, and she's like this rich heiress, and she's very, very arrogant, very mean, very nasty. And I can't remember the guy that plays the supporting character. He lives in, he's got all these kids, and they live in some broke down, he's like, believes in free love, like, just let the kids do whatever they want. The house is a filthy, nasty mess. It's just horrid. He's a fisherman. She gets overboard off of this gigantic yacht. And basically because her husband was trying to kill her because he's had enough of her too. Anyway, the guy pulls her in on his boat and brings her back to his house, but now she's got amnesia. So the kids and him figure out, we need a mom here, or they're going to take the kids. So they tell her, you're my wife. These are your kids. And she's like, ah! But she begins to believe this is her family. And when she finally gets her, she changes their whole life. She cleans the house. She does all this stuff. She becomes more who she is, changes the whole world. Anyway, she eventually gets her memory back, and now she, these are not her kids. This is not her husband. She starts thinking about, wait, I slept with you. Things like that, right? But it's the transformation that makes the show so funny. Anyway, I happen to see that movie. I'm laying in the bed, all depressed, and that movie comes on, one of those morning 10 a.m. movies. And I watch this movie, and I hear myself cracking up. That's what it was. I heard myself laughing. And when I heard myself laughing, I thought about what my therapist said. And I thought, oh my God, I'm smiling. I got up, I went to the store, got a whole bunch of old, like, Dean Martins and who's that other guy? Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis movies. Brought them back and just spent the whole day in the bed watching movies, these old funny movies, cracking up. Had one of the best days I've ever had in my life. So I'm saying all that to say that depression can be that way also. There's a way in which we have the habit of being depressed and we get stuck in that habit. And so if this is not a situation where I really need to just get some help, that the only person can say that is you or any one of us that have it. This is just a habit that I fall into all the time. Then it's a matter, same thing, knowing this is a habit of mine. I'm going to practice with it, so I'm going to watch what is my thinking. In depression, it's more like you're watching your thinking versus watching the body sensations. You're watching your thinking mind and watching the things that the mind is saying and paying attention to how that is not lining up with the way life actually is. And noticing when the energy is not like that. That's what you're doing. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I think it's because a habit of mind, as opposed to being truly a chemical thing. And when it's a habit of mind, you have to see that habit, and that's a lot of what this 9 modes are. Is helping us see these habits of mind that we get stuck in, and then we don't realize we're in a habit, but we're in a habit. We want to try to get out of that. We want to see it. We want to see this is a scarecrow, not a real human being. This is a magic show. It's not real magic. It's just a show. That's what we're trying to see. Welcome. Let's see if there's anything else. Yeah?
This mind that we keep talking about sounds quite complicated. There's different kinds of minds I'm hearing. There's like, where is it?
That's a good question. So if you were to ask, like the Tibetans, the Mahayana, and the Zen people, if you ask them, where is mind? They would point to their heart. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because from a Buddhist perspective, the idea of mind is more like consciousness wisdom. It's like wisdom, like understanding. It's not the brain that the Westerners think. I'm going to point to the brain. It's the, what they would call chitta, the heart mind. It's like, I don't know how Buddha could see this, but I swear, the man amazes me. The Buddha saw three different types of consciousness. So he saw the citta, which is the heart mind, and there are 52 different states of mind. 52, not 53, not 54, 51, 52 states of mind. These 52 states of mind, they rise up out of what would be called the citta and the part of the mind, that we, the conscious level of mind, that we could know what state my mind is in. There's that. There, I can't say the Pali words to the other ones. But there's another state of mind in which we move through and have the capacity to be aware of those 52 states of mind. So there's an awareness aspect, the aspect of mindfulness, that we can know that 52 state of mind. So you got to think about it. You're in a state of mind, let's say, sadness. It's one of the 52 states of mind. You're in this state of sadness. But then there's another capacity that you have to know you are sad. And that capacity is not sad. It knows you're sad, but it is not sad. And you could rest in that state of mind. And now I'm going to really go out there. Right? There's an aspect of consciousness that lights up our ability to know we are sad and the sadness, right? There's a capacity that goes one step out there that illuminates this understanding. And that aspect that illuminates our ability is not of us. So it would be like...
Did you say it's not of us?
Yeah. So a way to think about it is, there is the table. There's a light that illuminates the table. And then there's the electricity that allows for this light to come on. That's what it is. The table is not the light. The light is not the light. It is just the capacity by which the electricity can turn light, can turn electricity into light. Can you see that? So in some respects, Buddha saw that there were these mind states that he would travel through. Then there was this capacity for him to know that he's in those mind states. And then there was this illumination that actually helped him, that lit up his capacity to know that. So, I said all that to say, I think that is what mind is. It is all of that. Both the capacity to actually transform this illumination into awareness so we can be aware, the actual awareness, and then the thing that we are aware of. That's what I think mind is. And we live in, where do you think we live? The thing we are aware of. Small, that's the smallest of the minds. We got to move back a little bit, get way more spaciousness. And when we can access that spaciousness, then our capacity to be with whatever is going on greatly improves. So we want to just move back one layer to the part that knows I'm experiencing that, but it's not me. That's the layer I'm talking about tomorrow. How do we move back into that first layer so we're aware of what's happening, but we're not trapped in it, of whatever that is. And then there's our brain. And our brain is a habitual moving thing. And so we often think our brain is us, but that's not the mind that we're talking about. I think our brains do things by habit, like neurons just get fire together. They do things. We do it as habit. We think this is what we're doing. We think, oh, this is me. But this is just the neurons moving together in order for us to move a certain way. And we want to see if we can move back. Because on one hand, you might think, oh, this whole idea of moving back into this non-self is just too, I'm too distant from the world. I'm just too distant. I can't, it's just too nebulous. I'm not going to even be really a part of the world. But I want you to think a different way from that. The part of us that can't help and fix the world is the part that's stuck down here, thinking the world is in this really, really bad way, this bad shape. We're like so caught in it that we are struggling all the time. Instead, if we spread back a little bit and realize just how much spaciousness we have, we would be far more courageous, far more active, far more involved in the world, because we wouldn't be overwhelmed so much by everything that happens. But we can't do that work with this chitta mind. We have to move back into the awareness.
So are the brain scientists, the neurologists who think about the brain, are they also twigged in a bit to what you're discussing, read
mm-hmm. They understand it more now than they ever did before. It's like John Kabat-Zinn kind of changed everything. If you want to know more and kind of begin to understand this kind of capacity, then you could look at epigenetics, which is like the newest of all the science, and neuroplasticity. They're just beginning to see that things they thought were hard and fast are not really like that anymore. A lot of the, just the physicists, all of them are just beginning to see what they thought was well-established science is beginning to shift and change a bit. But mostly it's talking about we have a much greater capacity to liberate ourselves than we think. We are not stuck in the limited thinking that are really part of those nine modes. We're not stuck in those modes. We can see outside of it if we just know and recognize there's a mode present. All right, we might want to stop simply because I don't want to get us too into the intellectual, away from this little bit of stillness we have here. I may not be able to do, well, we'll try it. We'll do the loving kindness chant at the end of the whole thing tomorrow. All right, so what do you think, you guys? Are you ready? Do we have to clean up, or can we leave everything as it is?
Yeah, we can leave everything. Just a couple comments.
Okay, so let's just sit still for just a couple of seconds, and then we'll have your comments. Trying to find this poem here, if you give me a second. Oh, here it is. Feather at Midday by Sister Dang Nguyen. If I had not stopped to watch a feather flying by, I would not have seen its landing, a tiny, pure white feather. Gently, I blew a soft breath to send it back to the spring. If I had not looked up to watch the feather gliding over the roof, I would not have seen the crescent moon hanging at midday.